Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Those of you who are regular listeners to this program know that one of the frontiers, if you will, one of the much neglected areas in which, well, the war for the free world is being fought, albeit mostly in a nonviolent way, is on our southern border. It is an area in which we are being invaded with regularity. It is an area in which lawlessness abounds, certainly on the southern side of the border and increasingly to varying degrees on the northern side as well. It is an area through which we have not only immense numbers of people coming illegally who are simply seeking employment or a better life or health care for their kids or whatever, but also people who wish to do us harm. There are few people in the United States who understand better what the stakes are in this particular battle space of what I think of as the war for the free world than our first guest. His name is Mark Krikorian. You see him in all the right places. He's notably a fixture at Fox News. You read him, I hope, in also all the right places. And you may have some appreciation, as I certainly do, for the terrific organization he runs, the Center for Immigration Studies. It is one of the best in the country when it comes to analyzing and explicating and helping particularly the policymaking community, both in the executive branch and the legislative branch, as well as the press and the rest of us, understand what needs to be done and hopefully will increasingly be influential in the implementation of those recommendations as well. Mark Krikorian, thank you so much for finding a few minutes to talk to us on what's, I know, a busy day, busy time for you. Welcome back.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you.
Mark, you were at the White House earlier this week visiting with President Trump in the midst of the various stages of the thrash that's been taking place, primarily over the wall, as the president has branded it. It is, of course, not something that he or anybody, on his team is discussing in terms of a 2,000-mile-long concrete barrier. It's clear that it will be in certain areas. It will have certain features, including non-physical aspects, technology, cameras, drones, and the like. But talk us through, Mark, why this has proven to be such a contentious issue to the point where we've now had the longest, albeit partial, government shutdown in American history as a result of the disagreement about it.
I think the shutdown really isn't even about policy. It's really more an issue of politics. And that's because the border security proposal that the president is putting forward, it's called the wall kind of under a rubric, but it includes more immigration judges, more scanners at the ports of entry to check trucks that are coming in, bringing drugs and people. So it's a broad border security package, and it's actually quite conventional. In other words, there's nothing radical in there. You could perfectly plausibly see President Obama or President Clinton introducing something very similar. So this isn't about policy, even though it is true the Democrats have lurched to the left on immigration in a substantive sense as well. And that started before Trump. But this is really about denying the president a win. That's all this is about. And it almost doesn't, it seems pretty clear it doesn't really matter to the Democrats what's in the bill. The president has already moved significantly in their direction. He's got $800 million in humanitarian funding, extra medical help and stuff in these very remote Border Patrol agents, offices that never encountered more than a handful of illegal aliens. Now they're getting hundreds of them brought by smugglers just to get their foot over the border so that they can then, repeat the coached lines about how they're fearing persecution. And then they're in the system and we end up having to let them go because we got nowhere to hold them.
And what happens to them when they get out of the system, as you say? Do they leave the country, Mark?
Oh, no. They're driven to the bus station, wherever they are. And often, in fact, and I talked to some people at the bus station in McAllen, Texas, the Border Patrol arranges for their relatives to buy the tickets. In other words,
a travel agency.
Yeah, it's a kind of travel agency. And ironically, in some places where the Border Patrol just had too many people and they couldn't, babysit the illegal aliens, they just basically let them go into the United States with a piece of paper saying, show up in 3 years. The advocacy groups, the anti-borders groups, were complaining to the press that the Border Patrol was just letting these people go into the United States instead of, providing for their tickets and giving them goodie bags and all the rest of it. I mean, the chutzpah is unbelievable on the part of these anti-borders organizations.
Right. Well, chutzpah seems to be abounding at the moment, Mark Krikorian. And one of the most egregious examples of it seems to me, is this insistence on the part primarily of Democrats, I think it's fair to say, that walls are completely ineffective. And you and I have talked about it in the past, and I think we'll probably talk about it before we let you go today, that they're not a sufficient measure. You do need interior enforcement and other things, but they do make a profound impact on trying to triage, the kind of incursions that we're currently witnessing. Do they not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Border Patrol is the one who's telling the administration where they want extra fencing or new fencing or whatever you want to call it, wall fence. I mean, you want to call it a banana, that's fine with me. The point is something physical to keep people from crossing in a particular place. And we know this because we don't have to look to Israel or to Hungary or what have you. The San Diego border, before there was a real barrier there, it was a complete disaster area. I mean, people every night gathering right at the border. There was a place called the soccer field, which was actually inside the United States, where illegal aliens would gather, play soccer during the day. There were vendors selling them tacos. And then when the sun went down, they rushed the border. Now that the fence is up and it's a bollard wall, there's a luxury outlet mall right on the border because order has been restored so completely because of the barrier that's there. And so if there are other places we need that, and there are, why is this even an issue that we're discussing to put those barriers up?
Let alone the proposition that the Speaker of the House advanced that it's somehow immoral to be doing this. Mark, we have to pause. When we come back, I want to get into a bit more detail this question of what kind of wall is needed, and has the president perhaps been disserved by Mitch McConnell in crafting the legislation that, as it happens, didn't get adopted yesterday, but will presumably be a fixture in what happens next. And that's what we're particularly anxious in to get your insights into, and what should happen next as well. We'll talk with Mark Krikorian right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Mark Krikorian is in the House virtually. He is with us from the Center for Immigration Studies, which he has run for some time with great ability and, I think, great impact as well. Honestly, he's one of a handful of people that I can think of in Washington, D.C., for sure, who have really helped the vast majority of those in the policymaking community, legislature, and many, many, many of us beyond, think through and hopefully address with greater effect the challenges we're facing in terms of illegal and, for that matter, frankly, legal immigration. Mark, again, welcome back. It's so good to have you. Thank you for specifically helping us understand sort of the the context in which the votes took place yesterday in the United States Senate, I did want to talk to you a little bit about the piece of legislation that Mitch McConnell put forward, just to get your insights into it. It, of course, had the elements of what President Trump offered last Saturday as a compromise with Democrats, but it also seemed to have, it was a little unclear, even to the executive branch officials who would have to implement this if it had become law, whether it would have permitted the kind of fence, you mentioned bollard fencing, the kind of fence President Trump has proposed to put into place instead of a big, beautiful concrete wall. What are your thoughts on that? And then we'll get into where we go from here.
It's kind of complicated, but originally during the campaign, the president called for, or was thought to have called for, a Great Wall of China kind of wall, something masonry, concrete, rebar, this sort of thing. Border Patrol really never wanted that. What the Border Patrol wants is some variation on what we're already seeing on the border. A bollard wall is what they usually call it. It's like steel pipes or tubes kind of filled with concrete, closely spaced. And the point is, you can see through, but it's hard to get over. Now, people, very athletic, trained people can, acrobats can get over that kind of thing. But even for them, it's difficult and it takes time. So that's where the president has moved in that direction. He even said, as a concession to Democrats, it's not really a concession, but it's the way he put it, we're going with what he calls the beautiful steel slats instead of a masonry wall. Well, that's fine. And that's partly a response to the Democrats' prohibition that they put into the funding bill, the one that lapsed a couple weeks ago, that the president was prohibited from building any wall structure on the border of a sort that wasn't already constructed somewhere on the border. In other words, he wasn't allowed to use those prototypes that were in the news. They built a little section of several different sections of wall in different style, tried them out. Well, it looks like the proposal that was voted down, but is probably going to, in some form come back, continues to prohibit any new style of wall. It looks like what the president wants is permitted under that, but it's not super clear. The Border Patrol has said they're pretty sure they're allowed to build what they want to build under that bill, but it's not clear. I think they will be able to do it. That for me, that's less of a concern. My concern is the other parts of the bill, the concession to the Democrats you kind of alluded to, which is how much is the president willing to give the Democrats in exchange for their agreement to actually protect the United States, which is almost a ridiculous discussion that we're even having.
Well, so walk us through that, Mark, because I don't think most of us really understand either the concessions that he's offered so far, let alone those that seem likely to emerge now that that bill, draft legislation, was defeated, as was the one offered by the Democrats that picked up more support, notably from, I believe it was 7 Republicans, but still fell short of the so-called 60 mark to get, debate fully pursued.
The big concession the president offered the Democrats in the bill that failed was to extend for 3 years the expiration date for about 1 million people altogether who have a form of amnesty already. These are mostly the DACAs, if people recall that, illegal immigrants who came before the age 16 that President Obama illegally amnestied with this renewable amnesty. And then a smaller group of temporary protected status people. We need to go into the details, but it's 1 million people who already have been amnestied by previous administrations. And the president just offered to extend the, the deadline basically on those amnesties. Now that got a bunch of Republicans and immigration hawks concerned the president was supporting an amnesty. I was less concerned about that because those people already have amnesty. I mean, the president's kind of dealing with this mess, or trying to deal with this mess he inherited. The Democrats, for them, it wasn't enough. And this is what I fear the next steps are going to be. is that instead of simply kicking the can down the road for those people for a resolution in the future, the White House is now going to offer, and there's reports that Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who's doing much of the negotiating, has already offered this, give them green cards. In other words, make them permanent immigrants and they become citizens in the future, and maybe even expand it to maybe a million people beyond what he's already offered.
Possibly including the parents who brought them here illegally, I'm told.
Right, exactly. And that's never been proposed before. And so that would be more than, that would be more like 2 million or more extra people beyond them. So would, in that case, that would probably be the biggest amnesty in American history in exchange for some relatively modest, important but modest, border measures. It's completely disproportionate.
Right. And Mark, one of the things that has been so vexing about this, and you've understood it so well and you've articulated it on our program and elsewhere, of course, brilliantly, and that is the effect that such an amnesty has on people who may want to come here in the absence of a wall in all the places it's needed, being, you know, generally able to do just that. Talk us through that, if you would.
Well, every amnesty has two consequences. One is that it's what you were referring to. It serves as a magnet for future illegal immigration, not because someone today in Honduras will qualify for a Dreamer amnesty, this one, but because we're sending the message that if you get here as an illegal immigrant and you keep your head down and you last long enough, you or maybe just your kids will end up becoming legalized and be able to stay legally. Well, that's a pretty powerful message. And if you're going to amnesty people, and I'm not a fanatic opponent of any amnesty ever, I'm just saying if you're going to do it, you have to take pretty strong steps to make sure we don't have another amnesty because of the illegal immigrants that ended up coming because of the last amnesty, just like we had a flow of illegal immigrants coming here because of the 1986 amnesty under President Reagan. The other consequence of an amnesty that any bill has to deal with, and the bills that were that failed about 1 year ago address this too, is that you can't let the relatives of people who got amnesty become legal immigrants themselves, essentially benefiting from the amnesty. And so you need to have reductions in chain migration, as the president has talked about. And so you need to have those two things if you're going to have any real amnesty in a bill. You have to basically limit the fallout. And there's no discussion now of those kind of measures. And if there were, then it would just become a bigger and bigger bill, kind of, they call it a Christmas tree in Congress. In other words, you keep adding things to the tree, and eventually it falls over.
Right. And the things that would be added, it seems fair to say, would almost certainly make matters worse. It gets you back to sort of the Gang of Eight construct of just a complete smorgasbord of concessions to the open border crowd. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And not just to the left, remember, because, and this was the key to this, the Gang of Eight fiasco, 5 years ago, is that it also massively increased immigration. I mean, if you're going to amnesty people, that's increasing legal immigration significantly, in effect. In other words, you're giving 1 million or 2 million or 3 million or whatever the number is going to be green cards out. Well, you have to balance that off, but pay for it, as it were, by reducing other legal immigration categories. And what you're talking about is, unfortunately, the dynamic in Congress is to give every interest group something, so you end up with even more immigration on top of the amnesty that you did, and it'll fall apart. I mean, there's no way anything like that is going to succeed, when in fact all we're talking about is a relatively modest measure to improve border security. Why is that even morphing into this broader discussion? It's absurd.
So, Mark, you, again, as I said earlier, met with the president. You heard what's on his heart and mind. What advice, without intruding on your private communication with him, but in public, what advice should he be taking to heart and acting upon in terms of this, well, unfolding travesty and what to do next?
This was a group of, I don't know, 15 or 20 of us. But it was with the president. He met with us you know, behind closed doors for over an hour in the cabinet room. So that was a good chance. I mean, he talked a lot, but we also talked. And my takeaway was, number one, he really does not seem inclined to want to cave in as he did a year ago when Paul Ryan persuaded him to sign a bad funding bill with the promise that he would take care of everything during the year.
Take care of everything, meaning?
Border security stuff. In other words, he would end up passing like the wall funding and the rest, and never did, never even tried. And the president was rightly bitter about that. So the president needs to stick to his guns and make clear that he's not going to just keep giving more and more to the Democrats every time they refuse to go along.
Mark Krikorian, I appreciate you walking through this with us carefully and, as always, very thoughtfully. Mark Krikorian, the Center for Immigration Studies. I know I don't need to encourage you to keep up the good work. It's needed more than ever, but I know you will, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. It's Vice President for Government Relations, a man who has been deeply involved in Latin America for decades, initially working with President Reagan in support of the Contras, trying to ensure that freedom was not snuffed by communist totalitarians back in the day. He has remained very, very engaged in the region, very knowledgeable about it, and has been working, I think it's fair to say, very thoughtfully on specifically what's going on at the moment, which is, well, I would call it a political warfare being waged by the forces of totalitarian communism under the communists in Cuba, the communists in Venezuela, and the communists in Nicaragua. And specifically, Mike Waller, our colleague, is engaged in trying to help the people seeking freedom in one of those countries, Venezuela, to secure it out from under the dead hand of their dictatorial masters, the Nicolas Maduro regime, and to talk about what's going on in a very, very volatile but perhaps transformative moment and what we can do about it. I'm delighted to welcome back J. Michael Waller, Dr. Michael Waller, for that matter, to our microphones. Mike, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk about what's going on the ground in Venezuela and, again, how we can help things come out right. Welcome back.
Well, it's a good time to talk to you, Frank. It's really a historic moment, both for Venezuela and also for President Donald Trump and his world leadership. If you saw the entire hemisphere rallied behind Donald Trump within minutes of his recognition of the head of the Venezuelan Congress as president of the country.
So walk back over some of the lay of the land here, because we haven't been able to talk much about this on the program to date. But Nicolas Maduro, of course, was the hand-picked successor to Hugo Chavez. So the tyranny that has afflicted the people of Venezuela goes back over a decade now, right? Just walk us through, you know, what has been the bitter fruit of the misrule of these wealth communists?
Yeah, more like two decades. They took the richest country in Latin America and turned it into one of the poorest, even though they had this giant oil economy that had started out when oil was only $9 a barrel. And turned it into a complete basket case where 10% of the country has fled as refugees, and people are don't even have basic staples like rice or things like toilet paper.
Yeah, most of the rest are starving, as I understand it.
Are starving, and then you've got a huge oil infrastructure in the country that was never maintained. It can't even operate. They can't even extract oil to sell because the kleptocrats have either stolen the spare parts or never bothered to maintain them. And so they can't even sell what they have. So the country is, and then you've got Russian criminal gangs operating on a very large scale there. You've got Hezbollah there. You've got Iranian agents there. You've got a giant multi-thousand number force of Cuban state security personnel running everything down there in the country. So even the army, which has been very politicized, can't function without its Cuban state police, state secret service minders.
Right. And on top of that, a country you haven't mentioned, Mike Waller, is, of course, China, to which Maduro has hawked, you know, years of oil production that it can't fulfill at the moment, that's in the ground. So we've had the whole idea of the Monroe Doctrine, in which for a couple of centuries, the United States has had as its purpose keeping such malevolent forces out of our hemisphere, completely thrown over the side. With what kinds of effects, Mike? What does it mean that these sorts of countries and subnational groups like Hezbollah are operating freely inside Venezuela and perhaps from there elsewhere in our region?
Well, it's turning everything into a mess. You have, say, Colombia right next door to Venezuela. Colombia is the size of France. It's a big country. It's even bigger than France. It's a country where we invested a lot to fight narco guerrillas, and we put down a 40-year, or we helped the Colombians put down a 40-year insurgency. And just as soon as this happens, you have a spillover of millions of refugees from Venezuela into neighboring Colombia. So it's messed up Colombia, which of course is on both sides of the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean, at the top of South America, with Panama sticking up just at the top, and the Panama Canal and all the shipping. You've got incredible ecological destruction. You've got a major source of energy for the hemisphere that's at stake there. You've got a giant system of refineries down in that area for the super tankers coming in from all around the world into the Caribbean. I mean, it's a really, really sensitive spot. Remember, John Kerry, as Secretary of State, formally renounced the Monroe Doctrine just a few years ago. So it's like they deliberately allowed this mess to come to this point.
One of the other pieces of this, Mike, which, again, we're talking about this in the context of the debate that I explored a moment ago with Mark Krikorian, of securing our border. One of the things that I find particularly worrisome about the presence of these various, well, not just unsavory, but downright dangerous elements in Venezuela, as you say, in large numbers, is that I told that Nicolas Maduro has been issuing Venezuelan passports to some numbers of them. And that would facilitate, of course, their migration elsewhere, perhaps as part of large, you know, caravans or other refugee flows, if things really go south in Venezuela even further than they have to date. Is that your understanding as well, Mike? And what does that portend if the Russians, Chinese, Iranians, and others take advantage of this?
They have already taken advantage of it. And remember, it's one thing to get a fake Venezuelan ID card if you just want to live in Venezuela illegally as a foreigner. You don't need a passport unless you're going to go to another country. And Venezuela has been a staging point for all sorts of unsavory elements from the Arab Middle East, Iran, and China to sneak into the United States.
And to the extent that this has been going on for some time, we've seen, as you mentioned, entire establishments created, the security services of Cuba providing sort of a Praetorian a guard for Maduro, intelligence services. There's been sales of weapon systems. I was told yesterday by one of our colleagues, Rick Fisher, that the most advanced amphibious vehicles in the world, the most powerful amphibious vehicles in the world, are made by China. They mount a 105-millimeter cannon on them. And these have been exported to Venezuela along with fourth-generation Sukhoi aircraft from Russia. In other words, there is an awful lot of hardware now, to say nothing of countless millions of AK-47s that are awash in that country, nominally to, you know, help prop up the government. But whether it's the passports, whether it's the arms, whether it's the intelligence services, I mean, this is a metastasizing cancer, is it not, in this centrally located country in Latin America?
Oh, absolutely. It's really astonishing that the world let things get this far. This was, you and I, Frank, we were very sympathetic to the coup attempt that the Venezuelan army tried in 2002. and the Bush administration then supported it for a few hours and then decided they weren't going to support it anymore, and they walked away. In 2005, we wrote up that plan, what to do about Venezuela. So it's not like people have not been watching this, and it's not like certain of us haven't had ideas on what to do all along. So this has been festering for a generation in Venezuela. So now, if you take a look at what's happened now, though, you had a lot of Venezuelan citizen action on the ground with the huge movements of protesters and so forth. And then this very young politician, he's a center-left, very appealing center-left politician, not anti-American, he's just center-left, who said, look, I will be glad to be appointed president, interim president, as the Constitution allows, if the Congress wants me to. Their Congress down there is called the National Assembly, is the only democratically elected body in Venezuela. And under that constitution, the Congress has the right to name its speaker interim president if the president is violating the constitution. Therefore, he is a duly elected president of the country. And when President Trump recognized him as de facto president, as interim president, that unleashed within minutes on Twitter, it unleashed the Organization of American States president recognizing it. That's the hemispheric body of all the countries in the hemisphere except Cuba. So the president of that recognized him. He's no right winger. He's a lefty. And then you had Brazil recognize him, and Canada recognize him, and then almost the entire hemisphere right away. And then it started to spill over into Europe. And this is just with Donald Trump's leadership following the courage of this young Venezuelan congressman. And there was a lot of work being done behind the scenes by Senator Marco Rubio to help make this happen and to help prep the Trump administration for this. Rubio has been involved very deeply on Spanish language Twitter, working with these folks. And then apparently he worked with Vice President Mike Pence to issue a video statement saying we welcome the new interim president of Venezuela, and then President Trump's tweet that we're indeed recognizing him. So it's an amazing feat of diplomacy, all done on Twitter.
And somehow that's the vintage Trump, isn't it? This would be his vehicle of choice to impress upon the world what is American policy and what will be the character of American leadership going forward. And Mike, that's where I want to go with you next. We're going to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with more with Dr. J. Michael Waller, not only one of our country's leading experts on the Latin American region, but also a professor and practitioner of the art of political warfare, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Waller, a senior experienced hand on matters involving public policy in general, specifically national security, and a particular passion of his over many years has been Latin America, where he really cut his teeth under President Ronald Reagan, helping the Contras try to secure freedom for the people in their own country of El Salvador, but also elsewhere in that region. Mike, we're talking about Venezuela today, of course, and as you say, this is an incalculably important moment, both for the people, the long-suffering people of Venezuela, but also potentially for the region. As John Bolton, the president's national security advisor, has recently said, there's a troika of tyranny operating there, Venezuela being one element of it, Cuba being another, and Nicaragua a third. I did want to talk with you a little bit further about what is next, as you see it. What should the United States be doing at this point going forward to try to both protect the new president on an interim basis of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, and to help him secure the well, fundamental transformation, if I can use that word, defenestration or lustration of his country to try to restore real democracy there and end this reign of terror that we've seen from the tyrants, Hugo Chavez and now Nicolas Maduro?
Well, first of all, this whole thing was not well planned out. On the Venezuelan side, there was a protest planned for the 23rd of January. It was a massive protest, and that's when Juan Guaido went forth with the support of his Congress and said he was taking the role of interim president. Other than that, it really wasn't worked out well. They were just winging it. I salute them for that. I think it's a great thing that they were just winging it, but it would have been great to have it planned out a bit more, because the Cuban-imposed security apparatus in the country is formidable. It seems that Senator Rubio detected that the Cuban security services were going to round up and maybe even assassinate the opposition leaders, because the day before, he tweeted out to the Venezuelan secret police, "I know what your plan is for tomorrow. Don't do it." And lo and behold, the secret police did not do it. And these people were not rounded up, and they did survive. So what we need to do, though, is to get them. First, the administration pledged some immediate humanitarian assistance. But what these folks really need right now is organizational support to help them develop an immediate strategy right now. What do you do with the secret police? That's the number one primary thing they should be worried about right now, because not even the army can function without the secret police running them. The mistake that the President Bush 41 made in Russia was to not help the Russians get rid of the KGB. The mistake that same Bush made in Nicaragua after our magnificent victory over the Sandinistas with a terrible amount of bloodshed was to not get rid of the communist secret police there, and still there in control all these years later. And I'm afraid that the administration might not recognize that now. This is the number one priority to get rid of the secret police. That means give no quarter to the Cubans. Don't let them out of the country. This is a way for the army to come in and reassert its honor by wiping these guys out. And it's going to be ugly. And I'm afraid the Venezuelans aren't ready for the ugliness that might have to take place.
Well, it seems increasingly as though they are, Mike. I mean, they've taken to the streets. They've been once again asserting their refusal to take any more of this. They're obviously standing with the new president, Guaido, but there is such a disparity in military power, or even just arms. You know, of course, as we all know, one of the first things that tyrants do is take away the guns from the people. And in this case, unless and until the army steps up, the correlation of forces, as the Soviets used to say, would be decisively against the people. So I was interested, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial this morning very much along the lines of what you've just said, Mike, that the Cubans have to be neutralized here. They're recommending throwing these guys out of the country.
Oh, no, no. We've got to round them up. Round them all up, interrogate them. I'd even send them to Gitmo. They're such an intelligence resource for us. And then what a humiliation for them to be imprisoned on their own island back home. We cannot let them go free. We cannot let them go alive. These basically guys, they should be dead men walking, and we should be rounding them up and using them as bargaining chips to make sure that Fidel or whoever the Castro clan is now are not going to cause further mischief in Cuba.
Yeah, well, fortunately, it's not Fidel any longer, unless his spirit is guiding that Cuban regime, which I'm sure it is. But Mike, as you're thinking your way through this, unless the literal states, and you mentioned Colombia, of course, another that has been terrifically and harshly impacted by the migration of 10%, as you put it, of the population of Venezuela, is Brazil, which is under new management. I mean, there's an opportunity on the ground in the region, as was evident in the immediate response from the region to the president's tweet. But what else could we be doing to help those countries like Brazil and Colombia most especially to contend with what's going on, as it almost certainly will be the case, the Cubans won't go down without a fight?
Right. Luckily, there aren't that many Cubans. I think right now we have trained excellent Colombian special forces. And I think the Colombian Special Forces should be invited to assist the Venezuelan interim governments to help restore order and take out certain targets as might be necessary. There's no need for U.S. military intervention on the ground, as we've been saying for a very long time. This is something that Venezuela and its immediate neighbors can handle on their own. But what we can do is supply immediate intelligence. What are the secret police planning? Let's keep the good guys warned about it. What are the Cubans up to? Let's keep them warned about it. Provide logistical support for all kinds of aid. There's a lot that can be done. It's just the sheer massive amount of emergency assistance for the people who are starving and who have terrible health conditions. They need help. We could be sending one of our Navy hospital ships offshore to provide that kind of assistance right away. We can certainly be, the Canadians would certainly be active. Canada was one of the very early supporters of this recognition of the new government. Brazil has a substantial Navy of its own. Brazil and Argentina both have aircraft carriers that don't get any use at all that might be put to use here as part of an inter-American presence off the Venezuelan coast without using American forces. So I think this would be a great experiment to help a lot of these Latin American countries assert their own sovereignty and not have the gringos running around the area by taking care of the problem themselves, but in partnership with us.
Mike Waller, does the competency exist in the United States government any longer to perform this kind of role? One of our colleagues was bemoaning the fact recently to me that the Green Beret, for example, which had initially had this sort of thing as their explicit primary mission, have long since, sort of been weaned of the skill set and the training and the competency to do it. Heavens knows the Central Intelligence Agency has fallen on hard times in recent years, particularly under the Obama team. What do you believe, if the president understands this, if the vice president does, Marco Rubio, John Bolton, others in key leadership positions do we still have the wherewithal as a nation to try to provide the kind of leadership and assistance that you've just described?
We can wing it. I don't think we certainly don't have it inside. The CIA has been changed drastically. It's a terrorism hunting organization more than anything else. And those with linguistic and other cultural skills in Latin America, they were not rewarded professionally, and there aren't a whole lot of them left in the clandestine service. On the analytical side of the house, I think it's pretty deplorable. Even 20 years ago, when, say, General Clapper was head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, he was defending the most radical pro-Castro elements analysts within the DIA and throwing out the conservatives, meaning that you had far left-wing intelligence analysis being put out as a legitimate product. And of course, one of the people he was defending ended up being the Cuban spy, Anabella Montes, who was the DIA analyst. So this is just a decay that's been, and it's worse now. So you have the seven special forces, which are which are responsible for operations in Latin America. They're in fine shape. They have a great partnership with a lot of countries in the region.
Mike Waller, God bless you, my friend. Thank you for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy these days and for our country more generally. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.